Welcome to Unique Connections at the Table. I'm Dr. Beverly Samways, and each episode we invite you to join the conversation and discover new ways of seeing the world, particularly in relation to those with learning disabilities. So pull up a chair, the table's set, and we're so glad you're here.
How's your morning been?
It's been good. I mean, it's so sunny and gorgeous, isn't it?
So lovely.
It's glorious.
Yeah, although I'm going to Italy at the end of the month. And I've seen that it's currently looking colder in Italy than it is in Coventry.
No.
With the worst, isn't it? And it's still a month away. It may well still change. But at the moment, I'm like, oh, no.
It's not what you want. But it's still Italy.
It's still Italy. Exactly. It is.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that'd be really nice. Yeah, I'm booking tickets to Ireland, to Belfast in the next, I think in May now it is. But I met someone at Coventry University. She commutes from Belfast every week. I know, it blew my mind. But she's right. She reckoned it was like 2.5 hours door to door.
Yeah, it's not wild. My first ever flight, like commercial flight, was to Belfast to go and get a visa to fly to America. And I was like, oh, I can do this. Oh. I can imagine that'd be great fun. Why don't we do that? Yeah. Why don't we commute to Belfast?
Well, maybe I will. I'll see how it goes when I go and visit. See if I can get myself a little job out there. Just a part-time one, not a full-time one. I'm intrigued to see. I haven't been to Belfast
before.
Lovely city. My friends just moved there, so I'm excited to go and explore. So that'd be fun. So, we were talking just before we came on here, weren't we, I was telling you about a school that I heard of recently. And it's actually, it made me so cross that we've got an article coming out with a colleague in Belfast, actually, and another one in Indiana about Indiana. No one says that. Indiana.
You do now.
That's made that sound so British. Indiana. We've got an article coming out around trauma-informed care in the sector that supports people with intellectual disabilities. And I put a section in. It was really ranty. And then they both, John and Paddy, that's who I'm writing it with, they said, like, you need to settle it down because it's really, it's just really cross. But what I was saying was in part in response to the school that I'd heard about, but I've heard it so many times now, which is this idea that a little bit of trauma-informed care is a bit dangerous. I'd heard about a school, a mainstream school actually, who has a lot of, a lot of challenging pupils, a lot of pupils who are from, really vulnerable and marginalised families, lots of difficult and violent behaviour that they're often dealing with from their students. And they'd had this trauma-informed care training, and the trauma-informed care training had basically just covered the ACE study. So this idea that people with adverse child experiences are more prone to health and mental health and emotional difficulties. And then also just how trauma manifests, and probably some stuff on polyvagal. Everybody flipping loves polyvagal theory these days. And then that was basically it. That's it. Somebody came in, did all of that. And what the school had taken from it was it had switched their mindset in terms of how they understood the challenges that some of their most difficult pupils were bringing. So previously they had thought of them as being badly behaved and in need of a firm hand and lots of discipline. But now, because of this training, they understood them to be traumatized and that they were the product of their adverse child experiences and their traumatic lives. And consequently, what they concluded from that was that the previous levels of discipline that they had been applying to these pupils was now no longer appropriate. But they had no alternative. So they essentially had, just given up on these pupils. They had just been like, they've come from traumatized backgrounds, they've experienced trauma. Some of them are still living in homes that are traumatizing. That therefore their behaviour is a product of those things. We cannot change any of their circumstances or the things that have happened to them. Therefore, we cannot change their future or their trajectory.
So there's no boundaries.
They had just let the whole thing go. They'd given up on believing that anything could be done to help these pupils. And yet it had become boundaryless. So the discipline had stopped. The attempt to rein in any of that had stopped, and they were feeling utterly hopeless about these pupils. And so I ended up putting something in his article basically saying, like, a little bit of anything is that like old adage, like a little bit of something is a dangerous thing. And it feels like if you get the first bit of trauma-informed care that just tells you, I mean, this ACE study drives me nuts. It's so useful and it was so revolutionary, but it gets misinterpreted all the time. This idea that if you had difficult experiences when you were a child, that somehow that is like an inevitability of your future, which we know is not true and not what the study was ever saying. And then also this idea of like that all we learn from it is that we learn to feel hopeless about people who've had really, really difficult experiences. And then like, what have we forgotten? Like, because it feels like the world is flooded with stories of people who were like, I had this really difficult childhood, or I had really difficult things happen to me, and I overcame them, and now this is, they've got, I mean, Hollywood's flooded with films like this, and we're flooded with books and stories like this. Like, but did we, what do we forget that when we hear about, like, when we have these, that actually, there's such a thing as post-traumatic growth and post-traumatic resilience. And many of the people who bring massive transformation into sectors where that are supporting people who are marginalized and who have had traumatic experiences are themselves had these experiences and understand that you can it's possible to build a glorious life from those foundations and those bases. So yeah, it did feel like this school had just dropped all boundaries from having training on trauma-informed care, and how scary that was. And it does feel like some of the resistance to trauma-informed care is like, if we really sit down and think about the fact that some of the presentations of the children we're supporting is coming from a trauma space, then somehow we have to stop disciplining. We have to like just relinquish all boundaries. We have to tolerate everything that they're bringing. We just have to be. And somehow that in order to be nice or loving or compassionate, you can never say no. You always have to say yes. Yeah, it's fascinating. So we mentioned, didn't we, last time about boundaries, and it felt like, let's talk about this. Let's talk about how boundaries fit into trauma-informed care, trauma-informed practice.
I've been watching a really good documentary. I'm going to say it's kind of documentary-ish at the moment, where a group of 10 students from a South London secondary school swap with 10 students from Arkansas. And pretty much none of them had ever really left the country before. And it's a very diverse secondary school in South London. And it's a Christian, predominantly white high school in Arkansas. So there's whole hosts of different things that are discussed on different episodes, like race and like family and faith and all kinds of stuff. It's really fascinating. But one of the ones that really stood by me is the way that the different schools uphold the boundaries that they're putting in, both for the visiting students and for their own students. So we've got this one kind of issue going on where a young person's just on, in America, the school doesn't have the same rules that we have in the UK around phones. They can have their phones out. So she has her phone out all the time. And the family that she's living with are kind of going, we want to build a relationship with her. We want to get to know her, but we can't because of her phone. And the two head teachers sit down together and say, how are we going to talk about this? Because do we want to say there are different boundaries around phone usage for her than there are for other places? And the British teacher that's out there with her, British student, says, let's go with relationship first. And I'm like, what a beautiful line. And so he meets up with her and they go out for burgers or something. And he says, the family that you're living with are worried that you don't like them. And they're worried that they can't build the relationship with you that means that you're able to trust each other and enjoy each other's company. And it's really lovely because she kind of goes, oh, I hadn't thought about the fact that I'm on my phone all the time because that's just what I'm always like. I hadn't thought
No.
about what it's like for these other people. And so he then says, we're going to put down some different boundaries for you because otherwise you're missing out on relationship. You're missing out on what it is that's going to come. And it ends up being this really healing experience for her because she's with a very different family to what she's been growing up with. Different values, different experiences. But it was this really strong boundary that the head teacher put in of actually, I'm going to come around every evening and I'm going to chat to you about your day and I'm going to have dinner with you and your family, but I'm going to take your phone at that point. Which the other young people were much more able to go, no, that's fine. I've got a different relationship with this. But he was putting down this real brick wall boundary of this is actually going to be how it is for you. Because the experience that comes for you through relationship is going to be so much stronger that I'm going to hold this boundary for you. And it really got me to thinking about how often we do, just as you've said, that kind of, okay, well, maybe we can't do anything, or maybe we'll make it easier, we'll excuse stuff, that kind of thing. Oh, she's got a lot going on in her family back in London, so of course she needs to hold her phone and this kind of thing. And there was this really kind of really gentle way that these two teachers met and kind of said, we both want relationship to be more important than anything else, but that means us holding a really strong, really hard boundary first to ensure that she's able to access.
So talk to us about, because you often talk about brick wall boundaries, castle boundaries. Talk to us about that, James. I think that's really helpful.
I think when we kind of say to people, we need to put in different boundaries here, we all get a bit like, oh my goodness, I'm going to hurt somebody's feelings. Boundaries are going to be like this really bad thing. There's never going to be anything good. I'm a bad person for putting them in and all these. And I find it helpful to separate it into brick wall boundaries and bouncy castle boundaries. So the school that you talked about originally had, I imagine, quite strong brick wall boundaries. You turn up at this time, you leave at this time. This is the consequence for this behavior. This is the expectations of what you have to do. So brick wall, there's no movement in that. Whereas the sort of the story that I shared, this American school had very bouncy castle boundaries around phone usage. So it's absolutely fine for you to have your phone on you all the time in school. The expectation is that you will still listen to somebody else. It's very sort of loose. We trust you to use your phone when you need to. We trust you to listen when you need to. It's very much more sort of, it's much looser in that. And people can push, just like you can push the walls of a bouncy castle. You can push it as much as possible. But either there'll be a point where you push and you go, I don't want to push anymore. Or you push and then somebody says, no, here is a brick wall boundary. I see it quite often in like in some of the work I do. So therapy generally lasts for 50 minutes. And it's called like the therapeutic hour. And my boundary is we start and we finish at 50 minutes. I will work with people where for what they need is for us to push that. And to push that boundary and get that little bit more. And that wouldn't be right all the time. Overall, I say I work to a bouncy castle time boundary because that's what is needed. But my arrival will be a brick wall boundary. I will arrive for the right time. But we will occasionally have to push that end timing because one individual may need that. 99% of people might not. But some people might. So with that one person, that's what.
And that's because that boundary is about the relationship, not about you putting up a brick
Absolutely.
wall
It's not me saying, nope,
boundary.
your time is up regardless of what's going on.
So it's negotiable with the person, even if they're not aware that that's happening.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think of I felt like I was in this dance recently with somebody with this sort of like the pushing of boundaries, and I also was conscious that I don't think she was aware of what was. She wouldn't have been aware what was going on for me. She wanted to, I didn't know her very well, but she wanted to meet for coffee. But she was a little demanding about it, you know, when someone is like, I need to talk to you, I need to talk to you now. And so I felt like I need to communicate that I'm not at your beck and call. So I said no to the first few suggestions. And then I think she suggested a Saturday, and that's my like clear day off. So I spend time with people that give me life. And if somebody's saying they definitely need to talk to me about something, that's not going to give me life. So I was like, no, not, no, I can't do Saturdays. And then I began to realise that there was some, like, for whatever reason, it was important to her. And so in the end, I moved quite a long way to meet her somewhere. So in the end, I think we got on the phone, and because I was like, actually, if you feel like you need a conversation sooner rather than later, let's just get on the phone. And so I felt like there was some brick wall boundaries, and there was some bouncy castle boundaries where I began to move and negotiate in response to, you know, to what I could see was happening for her. And I guess that's what we are when we talk about how trauma-informed care actually starts to be implemented. We are absolutely talking about boundaries, aren't we? Because the whole basis of it is safety, and safety requires boundaries. It requires that that you feel held, which means that there's a boundary line where, you know, even emotionally, that there's a boundary line that someone holds you. There's edges, you can feel the edges of it. But also, you know, relationships, healthy relationships, have got to have boundaries in them. There has to be something that you can push against. You need to be able to find the edge of something. You need to be able to find the no. And that's actually how we feel loved. I remember I used to say to my sister's kids when they were growing up, you know, if they would you know, get cross because I'd put a line down, I'm like, I remember they were like really mucking about in a queue once, and I was like, just come and stand still and stop messing about. Like, one of them was so incensed that I'd done this. So incensed, I'd like told her to just stand still for a bit. So when we got home, I was like, oh, you're really angry about that. Like, why are you so angry? She said, because there was kids behind us who were doing much worse than I was, like behaving much worse. I was just playing. They were being really, really naughty. And you, like, why was it okay for them? And I said, did I tell them off? And she said, no. I said, why? She said, because you don't know them. I said, no, it's not because I don't know. It's because I don't love them. I don't love those kids. I love you. And so I want you to be the best that you can be. And so I'm going to put boundaries down for you. I'm going to say no, because I love you. And I want you to learn how to exercise self-control and to know how to conduct yourself in public spaces, and out of love I say no. I don't actually care about those children. I don't not care about them, but I don't have any responsibility towards them.
And some of those boundaries with your niece and nephews will be that kind of bouncy castle. Absolutely, it's fine for you to mess around when we're in the park. I'm not going to ask you to stand up to me as a brick wall in every situation we're in. But there are some things
absolutely.
Actually, this is what it is that we need to do.
And they move, you know, they keep moving, don't they? They move with age, they move with proximity, they move with how often you've seen somebody. They're really, really
moving. But things like a brick wall, you're probably not going to let your niece and nephews, when they're 10 years old, drive your car, because there are so many reasons why that isn't safe for them, for you, for anybody. And that's that kind of no, regardless of how much you beg for this is never going to be an option for.
Yeah, that's really true. And so if we think about how that might get applied into a setting, and I guess the principle is we are absolutely putting boundaries down, and we're putting them down relationally. We're not putting them down in a sort of rules-based, and that there might be some, you know, there still may be some rules-based stuff, but I guess it's when, you know, we were talking before about collaboration, we talked about working with rather than like implementing something to. I guess that's, you might have talked about that young lady who we worked with her against the fear, and rather than working against her and placing the fear inside of her, and I guess that's a lot of what. So I was writing about self-injury yesterday, which I obviously do a fair amount, and I guess like all of the different ways of thinking about self-injury, all of the traditional ways typically put the power and the responsibility into the staff member or the parent or the carer, so that the child is done too, to some extent. And sometimes there's good reason for that. But if we understand that the self-injury is coming from a experience of trauma, from an experience of emotional overwhelm, then we have to find a way to put some boundaries in that work with the young person rather than Absolutely. Against them. And I guess so to use two extreme examples, I think of self-injury that is rooted in a medical issue or pain. So it's quite common for someone to hurt themselves who has, because they have an inner ear infection. If you think about the experience of an inner ear infection, it's very difficult to work out where the pain is in your head. Sometimes it just feels like a headache, or it can feel like toothache or even eye pain. And so it's very hard to pin it down. And therefore, and even if you did have words, it would be quite difficult to explain where it was. So for a child with little or no verbal communication, they just tend to experience pain radiating in their head. And one of the ways that we all manage physical pain is by creating, we find a pain we can control to distract us from the pain we can't control. So if you're at the dentist and they're pulling a tooth out, you might put your fingers in your palm of your hands. And what you're doing there is you're focusing on a pain that you're in control of, to distract you from the pain that you're not in control of. So similarly, that's often a root cause of self-injury, particularly head banging. So if there's a pain here that you can't control, then you can start to bring a pain that you can control, and you can focus your mind on it, and that can help you to feel and to regain some control over that physical pain. So if that's the root cause of somebody's self-injury, you're not going to like partner with them against the ear pain. You're not going to think about, let's work on this relationally. You're not. You're going to get them to the doctors. Yeah. You're going to get them some antibiotics.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're going to make sure they. Yeah, you're going to fix it. You're going to get them some massive amounts of pain relief, hopefully. You're going to stop asking them to go to school. You're going to make absolutely flipping sure they take those medications, come hell or high water. Like, it's not going to be a choice. Would you like to take your antibiotics? It's going to be like, this child's having antibiotics 4 times a day, even if I have to hide it in a banana, with an appropriate care plan, overt medication. But whatever it takes, you are going to address the pain. Like, you're not going to partner with the child, but you will be like sympathetic and kind and loving and all of those kinds of things. And that's absolutely the right thing to do. But if the pain that the child is trying to distract themselves from is not an ear pain, but an emotional pain, because it's exactly the same principle, it works exactly the same way. You have an overwhelming feeling of emotion, like, you feel overwhelmed by anger or shame or anxiety or whatever it is. It physically overwhelms the body, and a child can, or an adult can, introduce a physical pain that blocks the receptors. So it doesn't process the emotion, it doesn't hold or regulate the emotion, it blocks it. And that's where the dysfunction comes in. But for a child, it can be very quick way to escape from an overwhelming feeling of emotion. But if that's happening, we have to offer some alternatives for managing overwhelming emotion, and that has to be through the processing and the regulation of that emotion, and that happens through relationship. That doesn't happen through being done to, or being, and that doesn't mean there aren't boundaries. But I remember, one, the first young lady I ever worked with who self-injured like this, and I wouldn't have had the words for this at the time, but she, she was self-injuring. It was almost a lifelong habit for her. But it was certainly coming out of a feeling of just overwhelming loss of self-respect. She really I don't think she liked herself. She had very low self-esteem, and she had, I think, she was just incredibly depressed. So any opportunity she could, she would take to hit herself in her head. And so we began to work on building her relationships with her and building up her self-esteem. So we had a principle back then, for about a year, where pretty much no one ever said anything negative to her. That doesn't mean she didn't have boundaries. That didn't mean we didn't say no. It doesn't mean that we didn't say you can't do that or you must or that. If she pinched me, I would say that hurt, and I'm not going to be able to come as close to you again for a while because you hurt me. So you're still working on those boundaries, but any opportunity we had, we told her that, she looked beautiful, that we liked her, that we loved her, that we cared about her, that family loved her, and that she was, and anything she did that was vaguely good or even neutral, we would praise her. And then any period of time that she spent not self-injuring, we would tell her that she was strong, that she had self-control, that she was an incredible person. And even when she started self-injuring, I remember, she would, I would see her start to self-injure, and I would go and say, "Well done. That's been ages since you hurt yourself. I'm so proud of you that you had such a long period of time before you hurt yourself. Now, what can we do? What do you need for me to help you to stop?" And so the boundaries were there, but the focus was on relationship. And even we had clear boundaries for how those relationships would begin, would happen. So I think, yeah, that's like that. I think that idea of that in order to respond from a trauma-informed way, we have to dispense with all boundaries is so upside down and so absolutely counter everything that we're talking about. But there's a cost, isn't there? Because there's a cost to responding relationally and compassionately as opposed to responding from rules. From I think the shift maybe is the shift from brick wall boundaries to bounce boundaries.
And that recognition, that holding of either this is where we're going, this is where we are aiming for this boundary to end up, or that feeling that actually there are still some that I'm holding that offer that safety and that containment. And between us, we are what we'd call like micro contracting. We are working out between us. Where does this work? Where does this fit? What do we need to change? Where are the edges of what we can both each tolerate? But it takes time. It takes time,
Yeah,
doesn't
it
it?
does. Yeah, it does. And I think, the as we've said so many times, the cost is greater, but the gains are greater. I think of what it cost me to work with this young lady. It would cost me so much. I was worked with her for about a year and a half full time. We're still in touch, actually. And it cost me sleep, it cost me energy, it cost me emotion, it cost me the cost of connection with a young lady who's in that much despair, because you feel it yourself. So it cost me a lot of tears. I would get really upset about her situation, but the gains were that, I have, we're still friends 24 years later. We're still friends. Yeah. So it's different. It's a
It's
different
different.
ask, isn't it? But I think it acknowledges what has always been happening in these spaces, but maybe we haven't had any space or language to actually acknowledge and honor. I was talking to somebody yesterday about a really complex young man, and I said to her, "How do you feel about him?" She said, "I worry about him, or I worry about him a lot." And I said, "Do you know what? I don't know that anyone else is worrying about him." So I feel like that's realistically, someone has to do that because he's very worrying, and family are not worrying about him. I was like, "I think that is probably part of your job. Now, are you getting the supervision you need, the days off you need, the support you need? Like, can you stop worrying about him when you're at the weekend or when you're on holiday? But let's be real, I think that this boy needs you to worry about him."
Maybe makes us think about another future week where we think particularly around what the roles are that we end up taking in that space.
Yeah, the cost of the work. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Good to
And you.
talk. See you
Bye.
again. Bye bye. Thanks so much for listening today. Before you go, can you help us with something? We want to make sure these conversations reach the people who need to hear them. So if there's someone you think would benefit from listening to this, we would just love it if you shared it. See you next time.